ever wondered if you were alone in the universe? Did we get here by accident? Or are we the creation of an intelligent designer? Welcome to Darwin or Design, focusing on the continuing debate over intelligent design and Darwinism. What does science reveal, and what are the experts saying? Darwin or Design, sponsored by the C.S. Lewis Society and Trinity College of Florida, also sponsored by the Access Research Network. And now your host, the research professor of Bible and Theology at Trinity College of Florida, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Welcome to Darwin or Design, the program that seeks to ferret out the truth about origins each week. We're trying to plumb the depths of evidence that points to the architecture of the universe having an architect behind it. And we're excited that we have, speaking of design or architecture, we have a gentleman that we're going to interview today who is an expert on the PhD sociology side of this debate. He has a PhD in sociology from Texas A&M, and so he understands very thoroughly the sociology of science as it affects the big questions of, you know, whether there is even a way that science can get at the evidence for design. And he also happens to have a degree in design from Auburn and an MBA thrown in. We're going to be bringing him in just a second, but I want to say a quick thank you to Dr. Bill Carl. I gave you an honorary doctorate.
Oh,
how's that?
Thank you for that.
Bill Carl, our tech director, is doing a great job week to week, and we're so thankful for ARN.org, Access Research Network, but we call them by their website name, ARN.org, our co-sponsor. They have a fantastic website. I mean, it is like a combination of the Library of Congress and the biggest Walmart you've ever seen in the world. How's that for a combo, Bill?
I wonder what Kevin's going to say about
that. Yeah, I think he's going to go crazy with that one. But I mean, this is evidence on design. If it exists, it's going to be at ARN.org. I mean, We have our own parallel website, more focused on historical and theological apologetics, along with intelligent design. That's apologetics.org. So we'd invite you to really kind of bookmark both of those websites. Visit us often, early and often, as they say. Vote early and often at the websites arn.org and apologetics.org. And of course, we want to just say thank you to all of those who listen up in the New York City and New Jersey metro area. We're looking forward to developing a kind of a quick tour, hopefully in June. Kevin and I, looks like we'll be flying out and doing kind of a whirlwind tour of number of cities and, you know, meeting here and there, having special, exciting, our own version, I guess, of the Tea Party, Tea Party. I'm getting a little political there. I'll back off from that. But we're going to have our own tour and speak in a number of places. Kevin Wirth, co-host, and I will be up there, and we'll just stay tuned for the details for that kind of Philadelphia, but especially New York and New Jersey metro area tour of Darwin or Design. Let's go ahead and bring on from his office out in Texas, the Houston, Texas area, a friend of mine I met at an intelligent design conference in North Carolina several years back, Dr. Donald McDonald. And Dr. McDonald, can I go ahead and just bring you in now and refer to you as the prof?
I'm here, and Don works fine.
Okay, Don. Sometimes I tell my students at Trinity College, just for a short nickname, I said, call me Prof. So, well, I will, Dr. Prof. McDonald, I'll call you by Don, if that's okay. We have I've been excited especially to look forward to this program because I have heard you speak on our campus, both on the sociology of science and how social forces and currents of belief and even peer pressure play a role in this area of Darwin versus design, but also how the scientific data just stares at us and really says something very clear. And I was wondering, as we get into this segment, if you just, first of all, just tell us a little bit about what you're doing in relation to the academic world, and then I'm just going to go right into your evolution versus science phrase, which I think is captivating and fascinating. But first, Don, if you would just tell us what you're doing there in the academic world.
I am a professor of human resources with Troy University. The degree is sociology, social psychology of organizations. I completed the curriculum requirements for the HR degree before realizing I had a better fit in the sociology department. Hmm. Once graduating, I continued in the teaching area of that area, but I'm always fascinated with and working with the sociology angle.
Wow. And of course, sociology, I've worked in that area as an expert in the rhetoric of science, because those are borderlands. The area of communication and rhetoric is somewhat at least connected to sociology. And we've had people work in this area of sociology and you actually speak at the University of South Florida on the problems with Darwinian theory. Speaking of which, I'm fascinated with this phrase, evolution versus science. And I've actually heard you deal with that on our campus at Trinity College of Florida here in Tampa Bay. What do you mean by evolution versus science?
Well, I usually do get a rise out of people when they hear me say that, and they say, well, don't you mean religion versus science?
Hmm.
I say, well, yeah, you could refer to evolution as a religion if you'd like.
Wow.
What I mean by the phrase is that Darwinian evolution is not necessarily pure science. There's a lot of assumptions underlying it which don't necessarily fit science. And if we can look at the facts, we should be able to come to some type of understanding on that.
And so you're really probing the foundations of the claim that Darwinian mechanisms or Darwinian processes have brought about all the complexity of the plant and animal kingdoms around us. Tell us about the key weaknesses, I guess, in that theory, principles of the theory, and especially when it comes to mutation.
Yeah, the theory is based on a couple of things happening. First, there's variation occurring randomly.
Okay.
The assumption there is that nothing is directing it, but just that from one generation to the next, there's going to be slight changes of some type. I don't look like my parents. You don't look like your parents. Something slightly different has happened. The next point is that there should be a competition for survival. The ones that survive long enough to reproduce would be the ones that have the more favorable characteristics.
Right.
Those two put together are the total of the theory, and frankly, its simplicity is very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And those basic facts right there sound very workable. That they would result in over a long period of time, lots of major change.
So where does the problem arise?
The problem occurs with that. First, variation idea. Variation does occur, but variation occurs in two forms. It occurs in mutation, and it occurs in adaptation. And we need to clearly distinguish between those, which I'm afraid I don't see very often explained in the textbooks.
Wow.
Mutation occurs when something new is produced. It wasn't there before. Somehow the gene in the DNA pool has been affected, and it produces something that was never there before. And then that becomes a new part of the gene pool, the DNA pool that then gets reproduced next time if, in fact, it's something useful. If it's not, it'll get filtered out. The other term is adaptation. It's another type of variation, and that's where there's just a slight shift in the total pool of DNA. Nothing new is introduced. Large beaks on Galapagos finches and small beaks on Galapagos finches. The genes are all always there, but when the weather changes in the Galapagos, becomes drier, the seed pods get harder. As a result of the seed pods being harder, the beaks have to be larger in order to break the seeds and get the food. The weaker ones don't reproduce as well because they have smaller beaks. 7 years later, El Nino shifts, turns around, the moisture comes back, and the beak sizes reduce again. So it's an adaptation is different from mutation. It's just a shifting back and forth, like the tides coming and going, in a gene pool.
Well, in a sense, this is like what we sometimes call in my talks microevolution, which is drastically different from macroevolution. And I was just wondering if you could just bring in. We have about another minute and a half in the segment. Do you see a similarity between this issue and a poker game?
When you're dealt your hand of cards, everybody at the table gets their hands of cards, and the person with the most aces or whatever ends up winning the pot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a matter of randomness as to what your hand is.
Right.
There's some skill in there, but let's just go with the random part of the cards. You're going to end up, if the person who wins then duplicates their cards, then there's going to be more of that kind of card. But if you wanted to look for a mutation, that would be like, you started out with 52 cards, and somehow a 53rd card came in there.
Wow.
That doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, and a typical Darwinian response would be, well, through gene duplication, you get a second copy of gene X, and that second unused copy is then played on by the random forces of nature and then turns into something else. And that's where, if I can just go ahead and pipe in, I would say that's where the numbers come up against the chances of taking that extra copy of gene X and turning it into that beautiful 53rd card that really will, you know, will fit and work and do something new in the organism. And so I was wondering if you would just let me, as we're winding out this first segment, let me just, if you've joined us, let you be aware that Dr. Donald McDonald, the one who we're interviewing today, is a professor at Troy University. His expertise is in human resources and the sociology area. His PhD is from the Texas A&M University in sociology. And one of the most amazing things about Dr. Don McDonald, I'll refer to him as Dr. Don, maybe, if I could, out of sheer respect, is that he has a life story that is absolutely incredible. And we want you to, if you're willing to share with that, share that with us in the next segment, I'd love for you to do that. You're listening to Darwin or Design, and I'm Tom Woodward, your host, and we're going to be right back with Dr. Donald McDonald.
Darwin or Design is brought to you through the sponsorship of the C.S. Lewis Society. Since 1975, the C.S. Lewis Society has sought to empower believers and engage skeptics with biblical truth and evidences for faith, communicating the case for Christ and authentic Christianity to those in the academic world, both students and professors. To learn more about the C.S. Lewis Society and to access articles and resources mentioned during Darwin or Design, log on today to apologetics.org. Darwin or Design is also sponsored by the Access Research Network, a nonprofit 501c3 organization dedicated to providing accessible information on science, technology, and society, focusing on controversial topics including genetic engineering, euthanasia, computer technology, environmental issues, creation evolution, fetal tissue research, AIDS, and more. ARN is also a virtual clearinghouse for intelligent design information. Learn more at arn.org. Welcome back to Darwin or Design, focusing on the debate between intelligent design and Darwinism, with your host, Dr. Tom Woodward.
On our program today, Dr. Donald McDonald, I consider him a spectacular expert on the forces in science, the social kind of belief molding forces that lead people down different pathways of conviction and belief and acceptance of scientific theories. Dr. McDonald's PhD is from the Texas A&M University, a very renowned university there in Texas, where I did my graduate work. And with his expertise in sociology, he is very well qualified to address all kinds of issues that are related to social forces and peer pressure and the whole area of how people come to form beliefs from influences in their social context. But the amazing thing, Dr. McDonald, Dr. Don, as I called you in our first segment, is that you have your own story, which is really amazing. I mean, let me just begin by saying this. Have you always been this passionate about the Darwin design kind of framework of questioning? In other words, where does this interest come from personally?
Personally is a good point. It comes from personal pain, I guess you'd say. Yeah, it hit home to me. I was getting my PhD after having spent years in Christian ministry, getting a PhD to become a university professor. And during my dissertation, a subject came up which frankly had nothing to do with my dissertation, had something to do with my field, the sociological theory of organizations called population ecology that is built off of Darwin's theory. And they asked me if I understood what it was, and I explained what it was and said, yes, I believe that it's very valid. As a matter of fact, I think it's more valuable applied in sociology than it is in biology. I thought that was just an off-the-cuff comment. My dissertation committee stopped immediately, had a discussion among themselves, deciding my fate, began to talk about whether I could continue my PhD or not. And one of them finally volunteered and said, let me talk to him separately. And I said, well, how shall I prepare for that discussion? And he says, any way you want to, which means it didn't matter. What was supposed to happen was I was to meet with him and agree that Darwin's theory was valid in all contexts. And when I got with him, I didn't realize that. I started explaining what had happened with Darwin's theory, how it had good points, bad points, what was missing. And it didn't matter what I said. I finally had to just say, well, yeah, thank you for explaining it to me so that I could continue to get my PhD.
Wow. Well, this is extra fascinating to me because I work with students both at the undergrad but also at the grad level, and sometimes they really move into a crisis of personal faith. So, I mean, how could this happen to someone like you so steeped in apologetics training?
I did, in fact, have a crisis in my faith. It had happened before that point, though I realized that there were still many problems with the theory of evolution as Darwin had posted it. What happened to me was, even though I had strong apologetic training, I had never heard any of the objections to my faith. I had only heard, here's the archaeological evidence that supports the Bible, or here is the geological evidence that supports our interpretation of Scripture. But nobody had ever said, here's how somebody else looks at it. So I would encourage people out there who want to prepare their children or prepare themselves for facing the world, they need to present themselves with the facts of what others think, ridiculous as how they may be. What are the beliefs others have, so that you can build your foundations against that?
What were some of the factors that enabled you to kind of make this recovery, I mean, at various levels?
Believe it or not, that confrontation during my dissertation was a very strong kick for me. It made me realize how the whole thing was not logical, that there was not that strong a defense against this. It was a matter of a faith system that was underlying that had to be defended in any case.
You're saying that Darwinian belief was a faith system in your discovery there?
Exactly.
Okay.
It is a faith system. It's not supported by facts. It's supported by worldview.
Wow. And as I recall, when you shared this, to me, it's a compelling and incredible story. It's like I was sitting on the edge of my seat as you were sharing it with the students and with me at Trinity College. I believe you said that at one point, this is again before your dissertation phase, but at one point you were, I mean, it's like going through the motions. You were actually sitting in church wondering, you know, do I believe any of this anymore? Is that an accurate characterization?
Yeah, I had actually considered myself an atheist for a period of about 6 months, most miserable 6 months of my life. But I couldn't deny that there were arguments on the other side, and I hadn't waded through them.
Wow! And of course, you know, surrounded by your social, you know, sociology theory context, where you were being hit with this at the graduate level, at a master's PhD level each day. I mean, you were hearing things about, you know, we form our own beliefs by our influences. And it was probably, I mean, I'm guessing, was that an attack on the idea of objective truth?
The culture aspect didn't hit me as hard in the university. I would hear phrases like the Genesis myth. And I'd say, why do you call it a myth? And they said, well, a myth means it's true or not. It's just a belief system that people have. It could or could not be true, which is kind of a way of making you disarmed. But if I were to try to use the phrase the Darwinian myth, I would certainly get a reaction against that.
Right.
What was actually hitting me was having to read hundreds and hundreds of pages that explained how dogs making grunting noises eventually results in communication that results in language. And it was just, even though it wasn't strongly supported, it was the fact that somebody was believing this, and that it was in print, and I was being required to read it. And I had no support around me. That's another key factor. Get a support group around you.
If I could just jump in and do a plug for a book that has meant a lot to me to prepare me, as well as the students that I teach, on these kinds of basic worldview questions, it would be Jim Sayers' book, the book Universe Next Door, The Universe Next Door. We've actually interviewed Jim Sayer on this program, and so I don't know if there's any particular book that you have found helpful. I mean, obviously, Scripture itself, and I think, you know, many of C.S. Lewis's books might come to mind, but I don't know. Is there any book or two that you would direct people to if they were having these same parallel experiences?
You've mentioned some good books there already, Tom. Mm-hmm. I guess I would add to it Chuck Colson's book, How Should We Now Live?
Wow.
Or something similar to that, Tom.
Yeah, that's a modern classic.
So much is covered in that book that it kind of rounds out the whole issue.
Yes. That book, I believe, was co-authored by Chuck Colson and Nancy Piercy, and it is a fantastic book. Let's go ahead. I know we have just a couple more minutes in this segment. How has this whole experience, that roller coaster ride of loss of faith and then the challenge about your evolutionary non-belief, in other words, your committee apparently wanted to nudge you toward acceptance of some evolutionary framework, how has that all affected your direction in life? That is your personal passion.
When I was it took me a matter of a couple of years to hit the pit, hit the bottom in that, and decide that I wanted to view the world as an atheist. It took me probably 5 years to come back to the point where I was before. But then I just kept going, and I have become very passionate as a result, and have gotten involved in things like coming to speak at your campus and other campus opportunities. I've developed materials and spoken in high schools and colleges, public and private, in the United States and Australia and different parts of our country. And each time it just fires me up to realize that the questions are out there. People need to have a better understanding. And if they can lay down their guard long enough to actually consider the facts, the first thing I find is they become angry too. That they realize, wait a minute, somebody has been not telling me the truth.
Wow.
And it's been themselves.
Well, today we're talking to Dr. Donald McDonald. He is a professor with Troy University based in the Houston, Texas area. But, of course, Troy University has branches all over the United States, and I've just found out recently, even overseas. They work a lot with the Army and military personnel in general. And Dr. Donald McDonald is a friend of mine. We met at an intelligent design conference where I was speaking in Highlands, North Carolina, about 5 or 6 years ago. And Dr. McDonald, that was quite a conference, wasn't it, with Dr. Behe and Chuck Colson and a whole slew of just stellar speakers. I enjoyed it. I hope you did, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to get to, in the next segment, a little bit more on your activity. If people wanted to check out your blog, what would be the best way for them to see what you've been writing on your blog? Can you give your blog address?
The blog is academicfreedomblog.org.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's all one word, academicfreedomblog.org.
Okay. And I've just been enjoying it, checked it out earlier today. And if people want to just visit that blog, can they actually leave a question or can they drop a response? Is there a way for them to leave a comment?
Yeah, it doesn't have to necessarily be on the topic either. Mm-hmm. When I blog, each time there will be a place to make comments. And they can make a comment directly to me. It will not be posted until I see it. I don't turn down posts, but if a person wanted to write something to me personally, I would see it, read it, and it doesn't have to be posted. Also, if you go to that blog, you'll find there's a link to the right called Biology 101, and there's a slide presentation that contains, well, it's the one that you saw on your campus, Tom.
Right.
All the detailed facts about the analysis of the theory of evolution as Darwin posted it. With pictures and dialogue for presenting it.
Okay. Well, we're going to be right back with Dr. Donald McDonald, an expert on the problems of Darwinian theory and on the sociological forces that will lead people to consider the case either for or against, or neither or both, of those two key theories that are duking it out, as it were, in the academic world. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. We're going to be right back with Dr. Don in the next segment. Don't go away.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design, focusing on the debate between intelligent design and Darwinism, with your host, Dr. Tom Woodward.
We're just delighted today to have a fascinating discussion, a conversation going on between myself and Dr. Donald McDonald, based in Houston, Texas area. He is a professor, a very, very important professor at Troy University. He is involved in their, I guess you would call it, extension program, Dr. Don?
We have a lot of online students, and I work with online and our Western facilities.
Okay. Western facilities, I guess, would include a number of cities scattered across the western part of the United States. Troy University, of course, rooted, I believe, is it in Alabama where the headquartered, the main campus is that is?
Yeah, that's right. It's located in Alabama. Some of the campuses are there. We have campuses across the United States and across the world. I believe about 30,000 students all told. And we have students in 17 time zones.
Wow. Now, that is something very few universities can claim to have students in that many time zones. I mean, you could almost have a conversation anytime, day or night, if you're a Troy student. Just log on to some kind of internet connection network. Well, we're talking about, focused on, the Darwin versus design line of thinking, the theoretical ideas, but also especially the evidence supporting this or that side. And let me just go ahead and mention that I have been noting recently, I'll just stick in a quick kind of a breakthrough that we want to explore and get a geneticist in here and talk about it with a DNA expert. But the Y chromosome of chimpanzees compared to the Y chromosome, now that's the sex chromosome. I think it's one of the tinier chromosomes. I think the X is humongous and the Y is tiny. But the Y chromosome, comparatively, in the chimp and the human are so radically different. This was just announced in the last few months. This is one example of the evidence, which is really kind of a monkey wrench in the supposedly smoothly functioning machinery of the Darwinian side. And I was just fascinated the way that the Darwin side took that evidence of the Y chromosome and said, oh, look how fast evolution can work since we branched off from the chimps. And to me, that was a good example of what we would call, in rhetoric, special pleading. In other words, hey, look, if evolution doesn't work slow, it must work real fast. And if it doesn't work real fast, then it must work real slow. In other words, you can never falsify it. You know, whatever evidence you find can be fit under that umbrella. But we're talking with Dr. Don McDonald, and he is both a friend, a colleague, and a top-quality lecturer on intelligent design. We've had him speak in our own campus here in Tampa Bay, where we're taping the program on the issue of the evidence for and against Darwin's theory. Now, Dr. Don, you've been doing a lot of things and getting the word out about this evidence and about the kind of legislative ideas about protecting the rights of teachers. Could you first, if I could jump right into your legislative work, I was fascinated with what you came up with there in your former home base. Tell us about that work in the legislative area.
Well, it's an example of how a person can have a small idea and it can actually make a big effect.
Mm-hmm.
I think we many times dismiss these things that come to us and think, nah, somebody else has already thought of that. No, that's not true. In this particular case, I got to thinking about teachers who are threatened that they'll be sued if they present anything other than the theory of evolution, being accused of doing something religious. Well, I got to looking at that and thinking, well, hey, if everything in opposition to the theory of evolution is religious, then that makes the theory of evolution religious, right?
Hmm.
So the idea was not to promote or require anything other than the theory of evolution, but simply protect teachers who want to bring science to the science class that is not necessarily supportive of the theory of evolution.
Wow.
It's not promoting ID, it's not promoting Bible verses or anything. It's just simply saying that a teacher of science should be able to bring in supplemental materials just like any other teacher in any other field is always encouraged to do.
In other words,
so I wrote it up simply and took it to my senator in my state of Alabama in this case, and he looked at it and said, well, teachers can already do that, can't they? And I said, well, legally they can, but they can also, their superintendents and so forth can also get a phone call from the ACLU and be told they'll be sued, and they will require the teacher to take it out. So it's not a matter of just right. They need a protection. And he didn't know this was happening. Most people don't. He got on it with me, and we began preparing a bill. The Discovery Institute came in eventually, and they wanted to be sure that we worded it in a way that worked in the long run. And we, in fact, did not get it through the legislation in Alabama because there was such a strong opposition that eventually rose up, which fascinated me as well as frustrating me, because it wasn't above board, frankly. But since then, legislation has been passed in Louisiana, and others have picked up the wording of this piece and are considering it in their legislation. I think about 6 or maybe 8 states have considered it so far.
Wow. Well, you're hearing today, we're talking today with Dr. Donald McDonald, who is not only a brilliant lecturer in the area of intelligent design theory versus Darwinian theory, he is also the, if I can describe you this way, the genius. I'm going to call you the Einstein who's come up with this whole new approach to really protecting the right of teachers, this legislative common sense approach that really requires teachers, or not requires, that defends the right of teachers to bring in relevant materials to accurately portray the scientific case in this area of Darwinian theory. Dr. Don, you've done this work, and it's begun to take traction in other states. Louisiana has actually passed a law similar to this. If someone says, do you agree with the idea of the right of teachers to challenge the icons, to give evidence that challenge those icons of evolution, those pictures and those diagrams that are often used to promote evolutionary faith? If someone were to say, does your legislation help protect the right of teachers to bring in evidence to challenge the icons, what would you say?
The icons, yes. There's many of them. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be challenged.
Right.
There is scientific evidence in opposition to them. The bill does not protect anybody who wants to bring their Bible to class and refer to verses.
Right.
It's about science.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of what a person's foundation is, why they question it, the point is, do you have scientific evidence to support your position?
And if I could just jump in and just do a little promo, the DVD that was produced about 6 or 8 years ago called Icons of Evolution is really a great kind of crash course or introduction to the very topic you're dealing with here, and that is what kind of crazy repression has been experienced, especially by one teacher out in Washington State. He no longer lives in Washington State. He actually moved to California. But this teacher, Roger DeHart, his story is told with incredible power and poignancy and clarity as the administration up there in Washington, I think it was in Bremerton, really just came down on him for just bringing good quality supplemental materials in so the students could evaluate the evidence for and the evidence against current theory. Dr. Donald McDonald, you're actually involved in a number of areas. You've been to Australia, and you've done work there. Tell us about your ministry or your work in Australia.
It was a single trip, but it was very significant for me. It allowed me to see that there's such a large audience of people who do not even have a concept for a deity, and they have dismissed it because they have bought into a false presentation of what science really is.
Wow.
And having had that experience, I realized how the presentations need to be altered. I mean, there's ministries all over that begin with God loves you and wants to help you with your life, but we need to start before that. People need to understand that there is logical evidence to believe there's a God before you even get into the other. So that's what it did for me was doing that, and I enjoyed that experience.
Right, and in my experience in Australia, if I can jump in for a second, was parallel that where I was able to speak about 36, 37 times in 2 weeks, and everywhere I went, at least in the public universities, there was some hostility, but there was genuine fascination and almost bedrock interest because they had not heard ever before about the case for a designer. So we're dealing with issues of basic background assumptions, college students coming into a discussion of the case for and against the existence of a higher power. And Dr. Donald McDonald, I'm going to go and just really ask you to stay around one more segment, because we're going to be dealing with some of your other work, including classroom materials and this whole question of the nature of freedom. And as a sociologist, I know you can tackle that. I'm Dr. Tom Woodward. We'll be right back on Darwin or Design.
Darwin or Design is brought to you through the sponsorship of the C.S. Lewis Society. Since 1975, the C.S. Lewis Society has sought to empower believers and engage skeptics with biblical truth and evidences for faith, communicating the case for Christ and authentic Christianity to those in the academic world, both students and professors. To learn more about the C.S. Lewis Society and to access articles and resources mentioned during Darwin or Design, log on today to apologetics.org. Darwin or Design is also sponsored by the Access Research Network, a nonprofit 501c3 organization dedicated to providing accessible information on science, technology, and society, focusing on controversial topics including genetic engineering, euthanasia, computer technology, environmental issues, creation evolution, fetal tissue research, AIDS, and more. ARN is also a virtual clearinghouse for intelligent design information. Learn more at arn.org. Welcome back to Darwin or Design, focusing on the debate between intelligent design and Darwinism, with your host, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Well, today we're enjoying a feast, an intellectual buffet, I guess you could call it, with Dr. Donald McDonald. He is an expert on the area of evidence that is running against the classic Darwinian theory, the neo-Darwinian theory. And I think he's also really primed on other, like newer alternatives on the naturalistic side, self-organization theory, et cetera, et cetera. And also, he is a very knowledgeable person on design theory that has been developed and articulated by about 60, 70 books over the last two decades. We are dealing with these issues constantly on our Darwin or Design program, but it's very rare that we have an expert in the sociology area, a gentleman with a PhD in this very important area of sociology. By the way, Dr. Donald, I don't know if I remember the details correctly, but didn't you, as you were recovering from the bedrock kind of crash into atheism during your PhD program, didn't you have as one stair step coming back to robust faith in Christian belief and faith in Christ? Didn't you have a little help from a group of Christian sociologists? I mean, is there help out there in this area for people to come at sociology from a Christian point of view?
There are Christian sociologists, and it's a very important area. Mm-hmm. Like, frankly, it's like any mission field where you would be the minority.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who goes into sociology, I was advised, yes, that there are other Christian sociologists. I found them at the National Sociological Annual Convention, but they were meeting in a small group quietly, like Christians in the catacombs, and they said, yeah, we definitely need more Christians in this area, but do not be strong on your faith until you're tenured.
So they were telling you to kind of lay low or lie low?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, but who's going to be teaching the sociology of religion if it's not the Christians?
Well, that's an interesting question. We are dealing, of course, with the whole area of Darwin design from Dr. Don, from your point of view, as one who is actually up to date on the major scientific evidences, but also is very sensitive to and aware of the social forces that shape belief. And as a sociologist, what do you see as the central issue, the central key core issue in the ID debate?
Well, to me, the sociology issue is the big point, because it's not simply a matter of presenting the facts. You can present facts all day to somebody who is not prepared to listen to them, and it doesn't do any good. Why are they not prepared to listen to them? They don't even know that it's their own culture. We all like to think that we make our own decisions and direct our own lives, but if our culture puts blinders on us, we simply decide whatever the culture dictates. We think we're free when we're not, which is the least free of all.
Mm. So then you have cultural foundations really are made up of these assumptions, things that are intuitively felt or just kind of creep into us from our, let's say, TV, media, teachers, parents, you know, the friends we hang out with. So help us to probe a little bit more deeply into these various strata, these layers of culture. I mean, what's involved in people kind of taking a good hard look at their own cultural blinders or their own cultural forces that are shaping their belief?
You know, when you talk to people in general, you meet people, and as you go through life, you will talk about very surfacey things, and you will see them do things. So we can call that the artifactual level, the things that people make and do and have and just the way we live our lives, and that's the way you, that's where you communicate with people. But there's a layer under that, which is your value system. What do you think is important? And if you have a friend, someone you're close to, you might talk to them about what's important to you on a values level. There's a level below that, which is your belief system. And your beliefs are the level where your religion is, your faith is, and your confidence in anything that you have built as a matter of layers of facts, or you just simply have accepted them because you've tested them in the past. There's a layer below that, which we never talk about. And it's the bottom layer, and it's the assumption layer. You think about in mathematics, you remember when you took a geometry course a long time ago, they had you start with a given. This fact is given. Now prove these two lines are parallel. Well, you can't prove anything unless you start with some assumptions. And the same is true for our lives. Is there a God? Is there a supernatural or a metaphysical even? And what is the relationship between that and what we experience? People don't talk about those things, but we get them, like you say, through interacting day-to-day with people. And we buy into them because that's what everybody else thinks. And we don't realize the most fundamental things that direct our thinking have never been said out loud. That's why we bought them, and that's why we don't question them. You raise them to the level of a question, then you can do something about it.
So those forces, those influences can be extremely subtle and very kind of almost imperceptible at times.
Oh, yeah.
Well, can you carry that on out a little bit? I mean, give us an example, maybe in the modern context, of where, like, even a social, subtle social meanderings in our own culture, where people are left to assume that theistic belief, let's say robust, ordinary, classic Christian belief, is like for intellectual cripples. In other words, people who can't deal with reality, people who just are not scientifically up to date. Can you give us just one or two examples?
Yeah, the amazing thing about this this reality that we do have these underlying assumptions that drive us. The amazing thing is that we self-censor. We don't even listen to or hear when something opposing our view actually happens. Think about yourself as you go about your day, you speak to somebody, you say, hello, how are you? They say, fine, how are you? If you said, hello, how are you? And they said, I have a headache and I really don't want to talk to you, you may not even hear it. You'd say, good, and move on. Because we're not prepared to hear it. And so people might see evidence or facts that contradict what they've been taught subliminally, and they won't even hear them, and they won't even know that they've happened. And this includes matters of faith.
Well, we're talking today, and I'm going to come back and deal with that point, just kind of pick it up and carry it a step further. We're talking today to Dr. Donald McDonald. He is an author, a lecturer, a blogger. He has developed clever, very strong and straightforward but wise legislative approaches to get students exposed to evidence on both sides, the scientific evidence on both sides of the Darwin debate. I've heard a rumor, Dr. Don, that your legislative model is on the Internet. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, the bill that we proposed initially in Alabama was reviewed by the Discovery Institute, by their lawyers, and with some back and forth, the actual bill that was presented is more or less what you can find on the Discovery Institute site.
That's cool.
It's in good shape to apply to any state.
And, of course, Louisiana very boldly, courageously, and effectively brought that type of legislative model to a smashing success. If I remember, it was an overwhelming vote, yes, for this new law in the House, and I think it was maybe a shutout, a complete consensus in the Senate. Wasn't that pretty strong?
Yeah, that's actually what happens if it's done quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The longer it takes to go through the process, the more the opposition will rise up.
Wow. And, of course, Governor Jindal signed it into law, and it's the law of Louisiana, probably with the most enlightened, or at least one of the most enlightened state policies governing, or at least affecting, the teaching of scientific evidence for and against the current orthodox theory. You have been involved in blogging and debating and writing and speaking. If someone wanted to get a hold of you and invite you to come and, let's say, give a lecture, especially, you know, if it pertains to these areas that we've been talking about, how would they get in touch with you? Would they just go to your blog?
I think that would be the easiest way to remember, academicfreedomblog.org. And just drop me a note as a comment to any one of the entries there.
Okay. If I could just turn our discussion for just a moment to the issue of maybe the sociology of religious belief as it pertains to the offer of life, the offer of eternal life. This is something that we try to deal with on a regular basis, at least, you know, as it comes up naturally here on the program. And I think that you would probably view the Christian gospel, that is the statement of good news, as a statement of core facts and not just values. In other words, when it comes to, there are values involved, of course, moral values that we've violated our own conscience, and so we know that there's something deep down wrong with us. But I take it from our, you know, brief conversations we've had that you would view the Christian gospel is containing not just value talk, but talk about real facts. Is that a true statement?
Yes. When you look at that particular issue of right and wrong, fundamentally on your assumption level, who is God? Is there a God?
Mm-hmm.
You only have a few positions you might hold. One is, I've done some things wrong, and I can overcome them. That's one possibility. That's not Christian. Mm-hmm. That goes along with a lot of other religions of earning your keep. There's another view, which is there is no right and wrong, which is the position that an atheist would take.
Or nihilist.
But in the area of Christianity, that is, there is a wrong, but the wrong has been paid for.
Mm.
That's the good news part. And that's facing the facts. The only way to face the facts is to understand that something has been done for it. I don't want to know that God is all-powerful unless I know that God is also all-loving.
Mm.
And that's the only way it can take place, is that God cared enough to take care of my problem.
I was watching the classic movie from the 1930s, I think it was 37 movie, on Tale of Two Cities, where the one party, one guy from England, although his parentage, his ancestry was in France, was nabbed, put in prison, and then a guy named Charles Darnay, the guy in prison, had a guy who was more or less a lookalike, Sidney Carton. And the lawyer, Sidney Carton, slips in, mugs him sort of with some chloroform, some chemical, knocks him out, switches clothes. They smuggle the body of Charles Darnay out, and Sidney Carton, the lookalike, goes to the guillotine the next day and literally dies in his place. And I was just fascinated at the end of this 1937 movie. It says at the end, I mean, literally, you see the words on the screen, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die." In other words, resurrection is a reality. So, I mean, as a sociologist, you would view that as an extraordinarily set of good truths, good factual statements, but also good news. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yeah. It's good news, but it's also an apologetic,
mm-hmm.
because there's nothing within man as he is to want to believe that he cannot do something about his own state.
Mm.
And the fact that Christianity exists as a religion, it would not be made up by people.
And especially the statement of Christ risen from the dead was something that the disciples, first of all, wouldn't believe, and it took the courage of the women to bring them to the realization, hey, this guy really is alive again. If those accounts had been concocted, they would not have had the women making the discovery and announcing it. Well, speaking of a discovery, we've discovered Dr. Donald McDonald, and he's on everybody's radar screen. Thank you so much for joining us from Texas. We'll see you soon.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Woodward, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on Darwin or Design. We'll see you back here next week.